This is Roger Wasson, your host of the Farm to Table Talk podcast. Please excuse us for a mix-up on the last podcast, Barrens. For some reason, the initial release had the intro for Barrens, followed by a different podcast. We corrected it, but not until hundreds of you heard the mismatched podcast portions. The Barrens, the real podcast with the book's author, Austin Frerich, follows here. Sorry about this. Thanks for being a regular listener, and now here really is my conversation with Austin Frerich, the author of Barrens, Money, Power, and the Corruption of America's Food Industry. Well, the food system can certainly be improved, and I have an author with me today that has some ideas about improving. And to start with, he's written a very interesting book that I've read, and I want to welcome Austin Frerich. And Austin, you've written a book about money and power and what you call corruption of the American food system. In the course of your book, you also give some hope. There's some ways forward that you're suggesting that could improve the food system of what you've identified. So Austin, welcome to Farm to Table Talk.
Thanks for having me on, Roger.
You know, Austin, in addition to it being able to enjoy reading your book and sometimes be troubled by some of what I've seen in your book, I also felt like I could probably relate to you because I grew up on a farm in Illinois, and you have a perspective of what farming used to be like in Iowa, and I've lived in Iowa too. I'm happy to see you coming from that perspective because some of what I see today has troubled me as well. And you seem to be concerned, and I get this flavor in your book that it used to be better than it is now. And that's an oversimplification, but am I too quick to jump to that conclusion?
Yes and no. I want to preface this by saying I don't want to romanticize the past in the food system, which there tends to be a habit of some writers. That said, I really do think in the last few decades, things have gone off the rails. And to me, it's really focused in on meat and dairy production.
Oh, really? Well, your book covers broader areas than just the meat and dairy production. And in fact, maybe this is a way we should explain a little bit how you've structured your book. You've taken, what, a half dozen different areas and you've identified to tell your story, Barrens, which is a word we don't use all the time anymore, Barrens. And I think of Barrens, I think of robber barons. Used to be something that we could say happened in the late 1800s. At least for a period of time, there seemed to be improvements that it reached a point that things, well, this is terrible. Things had to change. And things did start changing sometime then, well over 100 years ago. And in your case, you've identified barons to tell the story in each industry. Why don't you explain that?
I intentionally picked that robber baron framework because I do believe we're living in a second gilded age. And let me also just say the simple notion, kind of aha moment I had a few years ago was, the goal of any corporate executive is monopoly. That's where profits are. And so you just have a fundamental tension between government wanting competitive markets for farmers, eaters, innovation, what have you, and business not. And I just think this is cyclical. I just think we're, these markets got concentrated. We need another cleansing moment, another reform era to deconcentrate these markets, spur innovation, share the money around. And so what I did is I used each of these seven robber barons in my book to tell bigger stories in the food system. So for example, like Cargill is my grain baron. And that chapter is really about the farm bill and how now the farm bill is now designed just for Wall Street at the expense of everyone else. And then I have my coffee baron, which is like a secret German family who entered the American coffee markets in 2012 when they bought Pete's Coffee. And then they bought a bunch of brands, Panera, Krispy Kreme, Pret a Manger, Einstein's Bagel, Brugger's Bagels, Keurig Cups. And now they sell more coffee than Starbucks. And that chapter is really about antitrust. So
that last one you said Starbucks too? They're involved with Starbucks?
No. They sell more coffee than Starbucks.
Okay. And then probably through more shops than Starbucks, but since they all got different names, you don't find them every four blocks like you do in major cities anymore on Starbucks.
Yeah, you don't realize when you drive down a strip mall In most of America, you see all these different coffee brands. It's one secret family.
Yeah. I know the least about this, about the coffee stories, but go on. Then we get, you know, the coffee and the grain.
Yeah, the coffee. I mean, the coffee one's a great one because it's a big point of this era is there's this illusion of choice. You think there's a choice when there's really not. We see that a lot in the food system because companies want to, because of inequality, they want to buy different price points because that yuppie consumer wants to think they're getting a different product than the lower income consumer, even though it's the same product in different packaging. But I also have Driscoll's as my berry baron, and that's really about the offshoring of the American produce system and farm labor. I have a dairy baron, Fairlife Milk, they help create, and that's really about the Chuck Off program. I have my slaughtering baron, that's JVS. They're the largest meat packer the world's ever seen. And that chapter is really about how we're back in the air of the jungle. And then my final baron, and the one to me is really the king of kings, is Walmart, and they are my grocery baron. And that's really about what's going on in the grocery store.
And, you know, they're really, really interesting stories, you know, and I go through and it's, and one of the things that that struck me as you go through, it's not like that it's all evil, all bad. I mean, you've got families that got that in some cases became very, very successful and no doubt along the way did many good things and donated money to a hospital and sponsored little league baseball teams. But then they're able to have influence that is either discerning or you didn't come out and say it necessarily illegal.
I don't know about that. I mean, the whole story of my JBS chapter, my slaughtering baron chapter, is the closest thing we have to a criminal organization in modern day corporate America. I mean, they admitted to bribing over 1800 politicians to become a monopoly and we let them keep their monopoly. I mean, they pay a fine. I mean, they get alleged to bribe meat inspectors, they pay a fine. They employ kids, they pay a fine. It's just like there's no consequences. And to me, it's like a child where if a child doesn't face consequences, they just keep pushing their behavior. And that's how we get to the point now where, you know, there's children in the slaughterhouses.
Yeah, well, I'm glad you corrected that. And I think the thing is, I always want to believe the best in everybody. You know, I look at any organization and my default setting is that these are good people and they really want to do the right thing. And every once in a while, somebody gets off the reservation. You're reminding me that it's perhaps naive.
No, I mean, I just think power corrupts. I mean, what makes someone a baron is they're willing to cross ethical lines that other people aren't willing to cross. Like most pig farmers weren't willing to stuff their hogs into a metal shed. They saw it's unethical. They saw these are social creatures and they weren't willing to do it. But my hog baron was. He was also willing to buy off the governor, you know, evade regulations. I mean, there's this whole notion that we got to the system in America because of efficiency. And that's just a fallacy. I mean, that is just, you realize how there's regulatory capture and corners being cut left and right.
Mm-hmm. And and you had to pick some individual families. And I know a couple of these that have been around their industries before. And I've seen some of the good behaviors. And one of the things that did strike me in some of the industries I've seen, they're not the only ones in those industries. You picked an example. And there are some others that do very, very similar things. But you had to narrow it down. I think probably in each one of those industries, you could have at least another example or two that were.
Yeah.
Maybe like my hog, the biggest, but they're also doing some similar practices.
Yeah, I mean, just, you know, there's a handful of barons in each of these industries that control them. You know, I'm a writer. I had to focus in on the story, which baron to me was most compelling. And also, I wanted to mix up my stories and narratives. You know, I open with a trashy Florida money baron, but then Cargill to me is like very aristocratic, very waspy, you know. You know, there's a storytelling component to this, but you're totally right. There's a handful of barons that make up each of these industries.
Well, and of all the different structures too, there's some that are just totally privately owned, and then there's some that are corporate that can be just as bad in their own ways. And what I've witnessed, and I don't know, see if you've seen this too, is that some of the corporate structures where they can go off the rails is that they're able to have deniability. They can create silos, if you will, and say, well, okay, marketing doesn't talk to research or, you know, this sales, hey, we don't care how you get these animals purchased or something like that, but you better get it done or you're going to lose your job. And so there's some malfunctions or misfunctions or, you know, that take place in both corporations and private organizations. And even cooperatives, there's been some cooperatives that have gone off the rails. And I know you mentioned that in some cases, cooperatives are the way that consumers might be able to make a better choice, which is probably true. But anyway, it's pretty ambitious, Austin. You start taking in the whole world. I'm wondering if ever so often you get a little depressed saying, my goodness, it's everywhere.
I mean, on the flip side, I mean, I wrote this book over 5 years. I was very fortunate to meet tons of people doing it right. Radical Farmers of Iowa, Wisconsin Farmers Union. What you realize is just a few greedy people holding us back. And the point I always go back to is the system we have now is incredibly radical. It's really radical that one man owns 5 million hogs. And a lot of what we're talking about, these reforms are traditional and common sense, like putting animals back in the land. That's the way the animals usually were until 20, 30 years ago.
If your goal is to just produce 1 million animals or something like that, you want to control them, and it's hard to imagine how you could run 1 million animals and have them out on pasture land and old-fashioned hog sheds and the sort of thing that we used to have through the Corn Belt. You're going to have big metal buildings. And I think it's possible that they can do a good job with, I mean, a good job in then a lot of pounds, and the animals could have more space perhaps, but there's also a lot of risk. I mean, when you're dealing with millions of gallons of manure and so forth, that they make a little mistake, it's a horrible mistake. You know, it pollutes entire rivers if there's a mistake. When there's individual farms that are doing their own thing, it doesn't have the same level of risk.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the story of this system. When you concentrate things, you concentrate risk. And I mean, I just think of the old family farm used to have multiple crops, commodities going on at once. It was like a retirement portfolio, where in case one cratered, at least you had other things. Where now most of these people do one or two crops, and it just makes them incredibly fragile. And it's also why the farm bill is the most expensive it's ever been. It's basically massive corporate welfare and corporate insurance policy at this point.
I remember Joel Salatin. I've done some interviews with Joel. Mm-hmm. One of the first ones I heard talking about one of the biggest issues with the concentration is the fragility. Doesn't mean that it's possible to be able to have everything go okay like clockwork. But when you're working with 1 million this or that, a little mistake is a big mistake that impacts a lot of people.
Oh, totally.
What really motivated you? Was it being a resident of Iowa that remembered better days, and you started seeing that made you want to start going down this direction and getting this story out?
It's like a combination of a few things. I mean, what got me going down this book was just a conversation in a dive bar in Des Moines, where 2018 is a big governor's race in Iowa, and I didn't know at the time, Iowa doesn't have campaign contribution limits for state level races. And so I'd heard from this political person that this hog farmer had given the governor over $300,000 for his reelection campaign, and that he had a home in a gated community in Iowa, home in Naples, Florida, and have a private jet where he'd fly back and forth. And with the words allegedly, when pigs fly on the jet. And first of all, in my head, I was like, that's good copy. But number two, this is a really powerful symbol of what happened in Iowa of you used to see animals on land and now you don't. The rural Iowa now feels like an extraction colony. It feels like the Jersey Turnpike. You know, this is the world's best soil, yet none of the food in Iowa is coming from Iowa. And you just kind of see the anger simmer up. And then it's also going abroad and just seeing other countries' food systems. And you're like, there's something's wrong here. And so to me, I originally wrote that hog article for Vox, and I realized the story of what happened to the hogs. Oh, this is a story we see throughout the food system.
Yeah. It's interesting, your choice of words, an extraction colony.
So I'm the first in my family to go to college, and I went to Grinnell College in Iowa. And I wrote about slaughterhouse towns in Iowa for my thesis. And what I realized is, these are modern day company towns. For me, I've always compared them to like West Virginia coal towns in the 19th century.
Yeah.
So that to me is, I've read a lot of anthropology literature on this. And you realize in Iowa, the land's producing the most it's ever produced, but none of the wealth is staying here. And then a lot of the professional elite in Des Moines are just basically hacks for these financial elite.
Yeah.
And I mean, a lot of these people in my book identify as farmers, but they're really just capital asset managers. And so that's aggressive language to call an extraction colony, but that's what it is. I mean, that's just the world we live in. There's a reason why right-wing extremism politics is filling the void of the anger people feel in these areas. I mean, it's a tale as old as time.
You know, I've read a book, I think it was called Storm Lake. Are you familiar with that?
Yeah, Art Cullen. Yeah, Art Cullen's a friend of mine.
Oh, is he? That also got me thinking, too. There's a couple of, and it was interesting how the community changed. In their case, it was a large packing plant that came in there, and they were having to bring people in from other cultures, which in and of itself, I think, is probably a good thing. But just how that whole community had been affected by the changes. And
well, so that's an interesting town because it has two slaughterhouses. It has a turkey and a hog, but they've been there a long time. The big thing with that community was the unions were busted. And now they're both Tysons because consolidation. So what used to be a solid middle-class living in this community became exploitative low-wage work, mostly immigrants.
Yeah.
So yes, this is one of the few rural towns in Iowa growing because of, you know, these immigrants at the slaughterhouse. But you have schools where it's like 80% free reduced lunch rates because, you know, the parents are making next to nothing working in these dangerous conditions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And there's been some stories lately, even I think, was it in Iowa, where they were trying to change the law so that 14-year-olds could work to clean, yep. You know, could go in third shift and packing yep. plants.
That's the governor of Iowa.
It's like, wait a minute, what are they thinking?
I think to keep in mind for a lot of these rural communities where they fought power and they lost. I mean, there was a rebellion in rural Iowa against these industrial hog facilities. I mean, keep in mind, when these things go up, it destroys your home. And your home is your everything in America. It's your wealth.
Yeah.
And to me, a big point I focus on is Secretary Vilsack when he was governor of Iowa. Mm-hmm. In 2002, he's running for re-election. And his Republican opponent was the head lobbyist from a hog baron. And a big issue for that campaign were these hog confinements. And the way Iowa works is only the governor of Iowa can stop the construction of it. And you're seeing small towns in Iowa have gyms full of people opposing these things. Bill set campaign on the issue, ran TV ads, promised to do something. But then after he won, he oversaw the largest expansion of hog confinements in Iowa history.
Yeah, yeah.
That just breaks people. I mean, that breaks democracy. It's one thing. Earl Butz, Secretary of Nixon's agriculture secretary, never pretended to be the friend of the farmer. He literally told people, get big or get out.
Yeah.
Vilsack pretends to help you, but he undermines you from, like, he stabs you in the back. And so now in a lot of these areas, they don't care what you say. Your word means nothing. They think most politicians are corrupt. You have a defeatism. You have a nihilism that sets hold. I want to be very conscious of class in this book. I writing my Walmart chapter, I was very aware of it. I think a lot of the food reform movement has a very yuppiness and a looking downness to people that I think because I'm a first generation college student from Iowa, I come at it from a unique perspective. But I mean, we're in a hyper class conscious moment in America that I just want to be very cognitive of.
Yeah, no, I think we should. And you know, it's interesting because now I'm in California and I've seen a different perspective. I have to also put a plug in here. When I was very, very young, I actually was on a program with Earl Butz, did a couple of, which was, I look back at it now, I was wanting to try and find my picture that I could have with and say, gee, there I was with Earl Butz. And I got to hear firsthand him say, you know, go fence
road. That's funny.
But then now working in California, there's some different things. And one of the things I've seen here are so many good stories because when you go out into the valley and some of these large companies and some you've even referred to, they are filled with people that are first generation, that their parents came over and they were harvesting the fruit and vegetables and then senior positions and doing well and send their kids to school and, you know, get to graduate from Fresno State and come back and have a decent job with a farming company. And they're pretty happy. You know, it's not perfect. But
like, let's be honest, California never had a family farm tradition. It's always been rooted in colonialism. I mean, it's been colonial farming since day one. I mean, you don't see family farms amid the row crops of Central Valley. I mean, the largest owner of California farmland lives in Beverly Hills, the wonderful people. Sorry. And then on top of it, any labor gains that these workers made, and it took a lot of organizing, has been undermined by these trade agreements that essentially shifted any labor food production thing in California south of the border. Mm-hmm. So right now, California's mostly nuts because it's labor. That's capital intensive, not labor. So it's like, that's the dirty secret here is sure, things have gotten better. But like, California's a really weird beast in the food system. That's what I really realized is every region in America has a very unique agricultural history.
Yeah, Yeah, no, I think you're making a really good point. Having come from the Midwest as I have, and then be out in California, it's hard to refer to them quite the same. I mean, even the fruits that we grow. I mean, a lot of things we grow in California, you can't grow in Iowa. And so it's going to have to come from California or Chile or, you know, someplace else. If you want to have your strawberries in January, it's going to be a long time before Iowa grows enough of them. Although you could, but it's going to be a while. You tackle all of these challenges. And I don't know if you were writing the book today, because you've gotten some feedback. Is there anything you'd do differently? Would you say, gee, I better wait another 6 months and add another chapter? Or have people been pointing out to you, yes, that's really good, but you left this out? Is any of that kind of feedback coming in?
I would have, in my grocery section, really emphasized the point more that concentrated markets make it easier to gouge. I mean, that to me, that point is just so clear in the grocery store, because industry loves to say cheap food, cheap food, cheap food for America. And like, that's just not factually true. Most of your Western democracies spend less per person food than we do. And we're basically dollar for dollar with Italy. And so, I mean, the gouging, especially in the meat markets, is just rampant now. And, you know, when there's three companies essentially that dominate a market, they can get away with anything. Well, also, there's a general frustration where you need to have money to eat healthy now in America at this point, because the farm system is so weighted towards processed foods and industrial animals. Anything fresh, anything produce is just more expensive relative, because it's the other stuff is getting more subsidy.
You know, one other thing before we move on to the system and how some of the things that can be done to change it, to make it better. You raise issues about checkoffs. Why don't you talk about that a little bit?
Yes. I mean, checkoffs are a really good example of things that start off with good intentions that just went off the rails. I mean, they go back to the 1930s. It's something that comes out of the Great Depression in Florida. It's basically a tax on anyone that produces a commodity. You literally check the box. That's why they call them checkoffs, to advertise their good. So drink more Florida orange juice. These things really didn't matter for a long time until the 80s is when you start seeing them change, where as the farm bill changed to overproduce a few things, checkoffs became a way to stimulate additional demand for the surpluses being produced by the food system of a few things. So there's 20 or 30 of them around now. Most of them don't matter. They're like popcorn checkoff, Christmas tree checkoff, whatever. But meat and dairy is the big one. And the two ones that really raise concern for me is, one, the pork checkoff. Because of vertical integration, the largest owner of hogs now in America is Smithfield, which is owned by the WH Group of China. That's also the largest slaughterhouse. And so the largest payer now into the pork checkoff is a Chinese corporation, which with known ties to the Chinese government. So the voice of American hog farmers is really the voice of a Chinese multinational. And then on the dairy side, I tell that story of just my dairy brand essentially captured that program. He took money from family dairy farmers and used it against them. And I argue that a lot of the checkoffs realized this whole got milk, because they financed a lot of these got milk campaigns, they didn't really work. And so you see a shifting of dollars from promotional things and like dying magazines to capturing of financing junk science at land grants. As we privatize a lot of the land grants, checkoff dollars filled the void. So now you see a lot of this junk science, climate change and agriculture stuff, manure digesters, ethanol and airplanes, all this kind of garbage is being financed by checkoffs, because it's trying to essentially hide the negative externalities of these industrial, corporate, highly polluting industries.
Yeah.
And to me, it's like, I think it's what captured, it stymied any reform in the American food system, because it's the biggest revolving door for USDA officials. You go work at the USDA, you go work on the truck off, you come back to the USDA. I mean, that's what Vilsack did. He made $1 million between the Obama administration and Vilsack administration, sorry, and the Biden administration. And his job was essentially gut Canada's family farm dairy system so we can dump our surplus cheese and ice cream on those markets.
Vilsack got a really big salary. You know, you're right. He left and then he went to work for a Chekhov funded organization. But I have to tell you, I used to work for Chekhov organizations, never paid like that. That was a whole different era. And in fact, when I started, we had a voluntary Chekhov program that was implied consent and you could get a refund. And so it was before the mandatory checkoff. So we could go to sale barns and say, you know, we're going to do some research and some promotion. And if you will withhold 25 cents per head of cattle and send it to the organization, we're going to spend it on mainly advertising research. And then, you know, we could show where we do promotions and stores and have some benefit. It's a lot different today, you know, a lot different dollars.
And I really blame USDA. I mean, there's just no transparency and oversight of these funds. I mean, it's Dairy Charcoal, for example, is required to submit a USDA submit a report to Congress every year how its money is spent. The LSAC didn't do that for like 3 or 4 years. And it's like, it's almost makes it, it's like incredibly cartoonish because it's like, dude, you used to be a lobbyist for this organization. Don't you feel a little guilt? And I mean, there's tons of government accountability reports just documenting the amount of fraud and, you know, double dipping going on in these programs. And so I think an undercurrent in my book too is just how much USDA failed to step in and stop either these races to the bottoms in different food markets or just to do basic job of like transparency and good government. That's why, like, at the end of my book, I start talking how we should have an honest conversation over stripping USDA for parts. Because by every metric, it's failed. It's failed farmers, it's failed workers, it's failed eaters. The only metric it's succeeding at is for corporate industry, corporate agriculture.
Yeah. Well, of course, I would push back a little bit on some of accomplishments, because I've seen things accomplished with checkoffs. But again, I'm trying not to become defensive just because I've been involved with those, but I've seen it work.
So Roger, I had like literally an Iowa Pork Checkoff Association person email my dean at Yale saying I needed a talking to over a tweet. I literally tweeted that I saw the first multi-story confinement going up in Iowa. That tweet went viral, which, by the way, China has these 20-story piggy hotels, which you're playing Russian roulette asking for another COVID when you put that many genetically similar hogs. I do a tweet on that. And then the pork checkoff emails my dean at Yale saying I needed a talking to.
Yeah.
That got forwarded on to me and told me not to worry about it. But first of all, that person has gotten a lot of other people fired. And I would have been canned if I was at Iowa State. I'm very aware of it. I've heard people that have had this happen. This thing has really gone off the rails. And like, it's like good intentions. I mean, this is Florida orange juice stuff. Like this stuff was, you know, for the most part, you know, they're good things. But like they just got so out of control. And that to me is like the hallmark of this moment in the American food system is so many sections got off the rails. To me, is the hallmark of America, as we've always tried to avoid concentrations of power. I mean, from the way we've even structured this democracy. And what you realize is once someone has an advantage, you know, they use their economic power to corrupt the political system, to reinforce their economic advantage, which reinforces their political power. I mean, you see, it's a snowball. And once that snowball gets going down the hill, it can have very dire consequences to the point of like, I mean, we're seeing now in the food system, this is what happens when power gets unwielded.
It's interesting though. This isn't a new problem. And I don't think you claim it's a new problem, but I've been looking back at, 2000 years ago, there was dominance was what you refer to. And so there would be at that time, there would be people that would be in cahoots with the Romans. And so you can be back in Jerusalem and you can back in the other areas. And there's always somebody that had kind of the inside track. And it was usually, and it was a system of dominance. And so, you know, my own family came from Northern Ireland and they were in the plantation of Ulster and they were under the thumbs of some British landowner, you know, and drove them to America. So I think one of the things that even if you are able to accept the fact that there's historically, there's a tendency for these things to happen, dominance to take place, you point out that we did reach a stage after the robber barons of the late 1800s that a lot of improvements take place. And now is it safe to say that a similar period is going to be necessary to get counterbalance from, you know, that time over, what, 140 years ago almost now?
Yeah, I mean, that's on one hand, I think a good argument could be made. Vilsack has been Biden's worst appointment. But on the flip side, President Biden's appointment of Lena Khan to head the Federal Trade Commission is one of his best. I mean, this young woman is ushering in a return to this antitrust, anti-monopoly tradition in America. I mean, she's the one that brought all those anti-monopoly charges against big tech. She's the one that stopped the Kroger-Albertson merger in the food system. I mean, that's why at the end of my book, I actually talk about one thing going back to stripping USDA for parts is let's take its antitrust authority away. It's clear that USDA has failed in its, you know, at its duty to, you know, police the meat markets. Let's just give it to this agency. And I should also say what's incredible about this young woman is, I mean, she's like a rock star. I mean, she goes, you see these photos of American law schools. She walks in and the students love her. Because they, she's almost like that. You know, that's the Wall Street statue of the bull with the young girl who's like defying it. She's that come to life. I mean, this young woman wrote a paper, an academic paper in law school saying Amazon's a monopoly just a few years ago. And now she's taken on Amazon.
Yeah.
It's also good politics. I mean, it's weirdly bipartisan. Like, that's what I actually enjoy the most. You have Senator Josh Hawley in Missouri working with Elizabeth Warren about meatpacking monopolies right now. And that's where a lot of my frustration lies with Vilsack is, A, we know what to do here. We've done it before in the past. We've dealt with concentrated meat markets. But two, this is one of the most bipartisan pinatas out there right now. Like, take a hit at it, dude.
You know, there's so many things. And in fact, you do, when towards the end of your book, you talk about resisting mergers and acquisitions. You say end checkoffs. That's where we could go around again about make them, you know, improve them and so forth. But still, you mentioned the checkoff programs. And you also talk about institutional buyers can be encouraged mm-hmm. or to buy local. Really like that. And if you've noticed in my podcast, I've had several people talking about that make it a priority. And they could even probably make it a tax policy, that there's more incentives for you not to just call up Cisco and get the whatever's delivered from Smithfield or something like that, to be able to try to use local first and make it be beneficial to use local first.
It's also feel good. I mean, this is such a dark moment that people crave positive stories. Who doesn't want, I mean, I've seen tons of local stories in Iowa newspapers of, I mean, let's go back to Storm Lake. Art Cullen's wife, Dolores, is one of the best feature writers in Iowa. She writes a lot about how a lot of these immigrants, you know, also have gardens or farms on the side, their family members farm. And so the school district up there, you know, works with these immigrants, incorporates new food into the school. So like, there's a lot of Southeast Asians up there. So it's like, oh, the school now is buying lemongrass, cooking lemongrass, and teaching these other kids about, you know, lemongrass. And also, like, you're keeping your money local. The food tastes better. It's better for the climate. And you're basically, what this allows is, you're rewarding farmers doing it right, but you're helping transition one model out and one model in. So to me, it's like, as ethanol dies and cars move to batteries, all this corn acreage is going to come on the market for a new purpose. We slowly put animals back on the land. We help transition and stabilize those people doing it right through procurement. Because, like, who doesn't want every kid in Wisconsin drinking Wisconsin pasture dairy milk?
Yeah. Well, and now there's not many tools to try to make that happen, except like out here, what we find is that some of the institutions are drawing attention to the fact that they're using local because they think their customers will say, well, gee, that's good, even if we have to pay a little bit more sometimes. But that's kind of a weak pull. I mean, it's hard to have that be enough unless there's other policies that are making it better for hospitals and jails and everybody else to try to get used local more and more.
Yeah. I mean, that is, I never forget that everything you eat is subsidized. It's a question of what degree. If you want to serve frozen square pizza at school, that's heavily subsidized. But if you don't want to do that, you know what I mean? You are running uphill. So we got to change that subsidy structure too. I mean, that is a question over priorities. And, right. But keep in mind, this whole modern farm bill coalition is breaking down in front of us. And it was also formed in the 1960s America between urban Democrats and rural Republicans. And the dirty secret is Big Ag hollowed out its voter base. And I mean, you even have suburbanites were not even a part of this conversation. And at the same time, they can't even pass a basic farm bill because a lot of heritage Republicans are just, they're so sick of how much corporate welfare, especially in the crop insurance program.
Yeah.
I mean, food assistance is a whole different program, but like, even the farm entitled programs themselves are such a racket anymore. And like, I mean, it says a lot that that's where we are too in DC.
Yeah. So if you were going to, if all this happened the way you would like it, would you see a return, say in your home state of Iowa, would you like to see it again, that the average farm could be 500 acres and have, you know, several crops in rotation and have livestock on the farms?
I don't want to put a number on it because, like, it's very clear there's going to be a lot of robotics in agriculture soon. And that's not a bad thing. I mean, you go to any farm show now, these tractors basically drive themselves. So, you know, who knows how many grain acres a robot can do. But to me, it's more about the animals. Putting animals back on land. Because keep in mind, I really do think ethanol has been one of the most destructive things that happened to the Midwest. It pushed a lot of what it did is it basically expanded the Corn Belt into a lot of marginal land that used to be cattle country. And, you know, to me, for a lot of these family farms is, okay, there's only so many dairy cow one family can do.
Yeah.
And by putting those on pasture, it's like, okay, like, you know, they might have a few thousand grain acres and robots, you know, maybe they're making soybeans or like oil or what have you. But if we take away the subsidies that really incentivize, you know, corn startup up and all that kind of stuff, you're going to need less grain acreage.
It's such a big challenge. I mean, I hope that that people will read your book. I hope some of the things that we'll talk about will cause somebody to say, be inspired to what? Make another phone call, try a different approach, go talk to the local school system. Have you had any experiences so far where somebody said, boy, you've made me think about this differently, and I'm going to go do this now? Or are you just seeing the promise of that happening yet?
Well, let me start by saying you got to really galvanize people. You know, you got to aim for the moon. Even if you don't get there, at least you're in outer space. I mean, who knows? But there's no vision right now for the American food system. People, like, that's kind of, I just remember what a Farm Bureau person I would told me, like, their future of Iowa was six towns and a bunch of driverless tractors. But first of all, he's not wrong based on this current model. You know, they just want to keep doing more corn. Tear down more farm homes, tear out trees and creeks, and do more corn. Because it's all about selling as much corn seed as possible. But to galvanize people, part of it is, my goal of this book is just, here's where the food system is. Because I don't think a lot of people realize that Driscoll's doesn't grow a single strawberry. That they basically took the sharecropping model of farming, you know, applied to chicken, they applied it to berry production. I mean, that blows people's minds. Because they have this really public-facing narrative. You know, they write op-eds in the Washington Post with former governor Jerry Brown, yet their empire uses a lot of, you know, incentivizes production in developing countries that really exploits labor and the environment. And then they can, you know, play innocent. So part of my goal of this book is just to galvanize people of, like, this is where things are. But, you know, I'm having a lot of conversations with people, and it's hitting a lot of different buckets, which I find interesting. Like a lot of professionals in America, they go abroad and they just realize how much better the food is abroad. I mean, it's like a cliche now to say, I went abroad and ate better food and lost weight. At the same time too, you have a lot of Republican people, especially in the Great Plains, just really upset. I mean, what's going on in cattle industry right now? Like, if there's one graph I could include in my book, it would be what you're paying for beef in the store goes up and up, whereas what the rancher receives is essentially flat, and that's just being captured by industry. So it's like, that's what excites me, is like, how do you put together all these people that are mad about the system in different ways and kind of guide them all into this reform movement?
Yeah. No, it's a huge challenge. And when you speak of the cattle industry too, it's still one of those industries that can start with cow-calf operations that include what we used to refer to as hobby farmers, which is not really fair, mm-hmm. maybe, but people that are finding that, like, I think even Vilsack the other day, I heard him say that 88% of American farmers have to have an off-farm job. And he had some other percentage of what they quote call farmers are producing all the food right now. Well, they have to have an off-farm job, but some of them are these cow-calf operators. And I've heard people say before, the reason that hasn't been integrated, because there's a lot of people, that industry will have cows and calves no matter what. They're not, you know, somebody like Smithfield isn't going to say, gee, I think I'm going to raise all the cattle I need to. They might control a feedlot, but as long as they've got people that are going to have cows no matter what, they don't have to. So it's, you know, again, looking at all these industries, they're just a little bit different. But but that is a little disturbing when people start realizing that it's become almost impossible for people to have a full-time living just on a farm. They have to have a job in the city to be able to, or some other kind of income to be able to support a family.
And what saved a lot of these cattle farmers too, these hobby, whatever word you want to use, was there's been a spot market in cattle.
Yeah.
If you're listeners out there, think of a spot market like eBay, where you have transparent price discovery. Corporations hate it. They try to destroy it. They try to move you to contracts where you basically have to take a price, but you don't know what anyone else is being paid. I mean, this collapse in the hog industry, and that's how they're able to essentially, like, really drive down price and really put a lot of family farms into bankruptcy in the hog industry. Because once they broke that spot market, they set the price. The cattle, you know, they're trying to save, but it's collapsing. I mean, you see bills here and there, but they just can't get across the finish line. And it'd be great if Secretary of Agriculture would put his weight behind it. But I mean, he can't, I mean, he spent, what is it? He can't even get like that Made in USA label. So a lot of my GBS, my Slaughtering Baron, you know, it's Brazilian, but they also operate in Australia. And, you know, you can take beef from the Brazilian Amazon rainforest, take it to America, unpackage it, rewrap it, and put a Made in USA label until very recently. So a lot of the labeling too in USA just doesn't make sense. And Vilsack hasn't done anything to fix this. I mean, so there's just a lot of these little, I kind of view the cattleman as the last one standing in the family farm, like for meat and dairy production. And that's why they're so loud, is they saw what happened to hogs. They saw what happened to the family dairy farm.
You know, one of the things about fruit, well, produce in general, if it comes from another country, it says so on the package, but not meat. Meat doesn't have country of origin labeling. And this is one of those things a lot of cattlemen have objected to, that their associations have taken that position and USDA has. And so you can take lean meat from coming all over the world and blend it together and sell it into the school systems here and as a product of USA, because they did some grinding or mixing in the USA, and it might have been, you know, in the frozen and in a slow boat from South America somewhere. Boy, I tell you what, I don't know when I'm going to be able to have these conversations on my podcast, because it's intriguing. I guess the thing is that I feel pretty comfortable. I feel very comfortable in suggesting to people that they read your book. I think if any of these areas intrigue them, I think that they should check out your book. So we got to plug that again. So you,
or even to your listeners, let me know when you read. First of all, let me know your favorite baron. I love asking that question. Mm-hmm. I love grocery, but I also just love grocery stores. But also, like, if there's anything I missed, I mean, the best nuggets in this book came from people reaching out, telling me, "Oh, you should look here. You should look there." You know, even people within these industries that work for some of these corporations. I mean, a lot of people just aren't happy. You know, most people are just trying to get by right now, and I get it. But they're not happy with what things are going on. And so it's those kind of conversations to me that really help shed light to these things.
Well, and then also the book Barons is, do you have it in audio version yet?
Not till end of May.
It's an important conversation. And I would hope, as a reader and as somebody that's invested a podcast with you in this discussion too, that it will cause somebody to think about it and say, you know what, this could be different. We can take a different approach. And you do identify several things that can happen differently. And I think that gives people not only the opportunity to have some positive feelings that it's possible to change. And I, again, would point out, like you have, we've had bad times before, and there's been times where there's been corrections, and there can be improvements in the system right now. People don't give up. Read books like yours and take actions, like go to the local institutions and get the school system to try different approaches and some many other things.
I would just tell your listeners, if there's any other barons you think I should cover, let me know. That's another fun email I get from people. It's like, oh, you should look at this potato baron, this carrot baron. To me, this book is a result of, I wrote a lot of articles in different news outlets before where I was kind of workshopping these ideas. And I view this book to me as a living document of just starting a conversation, but I would love to refine it. But also, like, I don't know. I never view this stuff as one and done.
Yeah. Well, I think, and if they do want to get in contact with you, you can go to a website.
Yeah. My website is Austin Frerick, Frerick. And that's my socials too. All my socials are at Austin Frerick. Just Austin Frerick.
We need you to keep at this. There's more stories to tell, and you tell them well. So I look forward to hearing more reactions to even our conversation. I would expect some people listening to this today that will, at the very least, read your book, and hopefully there'll be somebody that will do something a little different because they read your book and listened to our podcast. So thanks for being on Farm to Table Talk.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, Roger.
You've been listening to Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson.